You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Bill, it's all over. The price of Bitcoin has crashed to $117,943.
Yeah, amazing, right? again, it's all over. So I literally just read a tweet from like a TradFi guy who actually came up with that because Bitcoin crashed by another 4% or whatever. And he claimed that Bitcoin still doesn't keep his promises. Yeah, it's ridiculous, but okay.
Hey guys, down from the high price of $123,000, but it's been a week. It's been a fun week.
Definitely.
And I think the timing of this interview is very timely. Number one, it's Swiss week here on TFTC. Unintentionally, we recorded with Pascal Quigley yesterday. We've got you on today, and we're going to get the Swiss perspective on Bitcoin, but your personal perspective, I think, considering what's going on with the price action today, is particularly pertinent because of the big themes that have been talked about in Bitcoin this year, which is institutional adoption, and more importantly, traditional finance really beginning to give Bitcoin a light mark of approval. And you sit at the intersection of Bitcoin and the traditional financial sector over in Europe. And we were talking about it before we hit record, but really interested to get the inside scoop on how these traditional banks and financial institutions react when the price of Bitcoin runs up like it did this week.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite interesting already last year. I mean, when you had a lot of critiques in 2022 or even earlier, where they said, well, there's no substance, no nothing. But then all of a sudden, the biggest asset managers of this world came up with ETFs, and everything was approved by the most powerful economy in the world. So obviously that changed quite a bit already last year. I mean, it was very difficult for somebody to claim that Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme and there's nothing behind and all these claims when the most powerful entities in the world are actively supporting it, right? So I think the story changed already last year. Also, the price developed nicely last year. I mean, fair enough. But then you clearly saw the success of all the ETFs, and then you saw the success of the MicroStrategy, and now in the more recent weeks, all these Bitcoin treasury companies. So, I mean, the critiques, they are a bit in shambles. Let's put it that way. It's very hard to say something fundamentally wrong, which was the case before all the ETFs launched. So and now obviously if the price rips, that's the same probably in every industry. That's not Bitcoin specific. Everybody is suddenly it's in the media again, and then people say, I mean, now we also had the latest point which was brought up quite a bit was that, okay, Bitcoin price only develops nicely in a low interest rate environment. Now that's clearly also wrong. So I mean, we suddenly push through all the points that were wrongfully brought up. And what you can see in the TradFi world is basically a bit of both. You have in the meanwhile, you have quite a few who are interested and are actually invested as well, but then you still have this a very strong Bitcoin derangement syndrome. So you can, as I mentioned just before, I mean, now the price went up in USD terms to 122K, and then it dropped slightly. And then you see these people coming out of the woods again claiming that it doesn't work, which is obviously stupid. But yeah, I mean, there's a very good dynamic in the market. There's a lot of interest from banks, from asset managers, wealth managers. I would also expect that a lot of the wealth managers, especially, they have to answer quite some difficult questions by their clients, because, I mean, I had just in 2-3 years ago. I had so many conversations about that, and then they claimed, well, Bitcoin is still not proven, it doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. And now it's again the best performing asset by far. So obviously, as a client, you start to ask questions. And now these questions are asked within the industry, which is great. So there's a good dynamic, and I'm looking forward to what comes next.
Yeah, and I guess it probably makes sense to take a step back and to educate the audience about what you're doing at Berglund and how you came to start this. I was actually listening to a podcast. I don't know if it was in German or Swiss recently. I was translating it, but you were talking about how you decided to start this company, how you view sort of becoming a founder, and it's not really going to market with an idea. It's really understanding your customer base and then building the solution that they're looking for, which is what you're doing right now.
Yes, absolutely. Well, maybe I can give you a quick background. So I founded my first company about 12 years ago, and it was a peer-to-peer lending platform in traditional lending, so working capital lending for SMEs. I led that company for 6 years, and we were active in Switzerland and in Germany. And we basically, well, we did a bunch of the mistakes that that a lot of startups do. So we invested too much. We had too high costs on a very limited base. Let's put it that way. We didn't really hit product market fit before we scaled the cost, which was a mistake. And then I saw a lot of the financing issues, like the lending issues in the traditional world. Nevertheless, I led the company for 6 years. We sold it in 2020, shortly before the COVID lockdowns. Then I became CEO of a joint venture between a large bank and an insurance. But always wanted to go back into entrepreneurship, first of all, but then also focus on Bitcoin full time. I'm in the Bitcoin space or interested in it since about 10 years, I would say. And basically wrote the whole ICO wave with a bunch of stupid crypto decisions, and then really started to dig into it from 2018 onwards. And therefore, it was very clear to me that I want to focus full time on Bitcoin. And then I thought, okay, so I'm involved in one or two or three other startups, and I see the same mistake everywhere, like the same mistake I did as well, that we got too much money too early on. We invested it in the wrong things. We built a product that turned out that the market doesn't really need and doesn't want it as much as we believe they want it. And so I thought, okay, let's do that differently this time. I just start by myself. I will finance it myself. No external capital. And I will try to really find a way on what the market really needs. So that's why I decided in the beginning of last year, I will just start with education and consulting. And the other thing that was clear to me was that I want to build a B2B business. But that was just a personal choice, because I feel like I'm better in long-term relationship building rather than large-scale growth strategies. So that's how that was basically very simple how I started, and then said, okay, I'm reaching out to my network and within European banks and asset managers and financial institutions. And it helped definitely that I had a network from my previous startup, but I also wrote a Bitcoin newsletter since 5 years, and therefore had a bit of a reach within the German speaking Europe, and that clearly helped me to get into a few banks and pension funds, etc. And then it ranged from simple workshops about what is Bitcoin, how does it work, what's self-custody, da-da-da, all these things, very basic, but then also to some strategic projects. And especially one was with a bank where I said, well, look, there's clearly a big need within the Bitcoin industry, which is that Bitcoiners do not want to sell, but they need liquidity in one way or the other. So clearly there is demand for that, and you guys at the bank, you have access to the cheapest capital. So fiat capital, that is. So, and then therefore they should go into Bitcoin-backed lending. And they said, well, I understand that, or they understand it. That makes a lot of sense, but it takes a while until we get there. It takes like 2-3 years. until we can actually push it through all our compliance and risk departments. And in parallel, I had a workshop with a pension fund, and there we really had to start on ground zero, basically, because they are still nowhere. Pension funds are, in my opinion, still way behind. And there was a lot of skepticism, a lot of questions still. And then at one point I said, okay, let's do it differently. Let's leave the term Bitcoin aside. I'll give you the opportunity to invest in Swiss franc euro USD. You get Swiss franc euro USD back. It's credit. You earn about 6 to 8% on the Swiss franc, about 8 to 10 on the euro, about 10 to 14 even on the USD. The collateral is always available 24/7, tradable. It's highly liquid. And the credits are always over-collateralized. So how does that sound? And then they were like, "Oh, that sounds more interesting. That's more our home turf." So that was then basically those two situations led to the fact that I said, "Okay, so then let's build that ourselves." That was then when I found the co-founder. So we are now two, still relatively small, but decided to focus on that as a management solutions with the overall goal to basically fuel the Bitcoin economy. And the first product is just Bitcoin-backed lending, where we want to allow institutional and qualified investors to invest through the different platforms like DeFi, like Firefish, but also through regulated custodians like BitGo, Signum, and all the banks that we have, because they have another challenge with capital requirements. So we want to build that solution to allow institutional investors to invest in these products. That's what we did.
Yeah, and I think there's many sort of points to touch on there. I mean, the first of which jumps out to me is somebody who's been following the space, leveraging these products, pun intended, and investing in companies offering Bitcoin collateralized lending solutions, is that it seems like the most mispriced credit instrument in the world, in the sense that you described the collateral sits in a wallet. If the custody arrangement's done the right way, it's not rehypothecated, it's extremely liquid, and the risk of a liquidity provider losing their principals is extremely low when you consider those factors. And you mentioned the interest rates that exist are, at least here in the United States, way higher than traditional sort of lending products, even though I would consider the risk to be significantly lower. And then on top of that, you have this sort of environment over the last, let's call it 5 to 10 years, where the rush to private credit and search for yield has been a big trend, particularly here in the United States, and I imagine globally. And I think these Bitcoin collateralized lending solutions provide an incredible risk-adjusted profile for investors looking to get exposure to credit markets, private credit markets specifically.
I couldn't agree more. It's insane, to be honest. I still can't get my head around the actual costs. But the thing is, the market dynamics are right now, they are as such that there's not enough fiat capital. So that's what defines the rates at the moment. There's still not enough interest. And that's also why we exist, because we want to change that. It's a lot of work. But I mean, I fully agree. On just the risk-reward perspective, I couldn't find anything that comes even close. It's really remarkable. And especially if you look into the area that you just mentioned, with all the private debt funds and alternative credit funds, I mean, there is so much money lying around there. And they're chasing returns of, let's say, 10% on the USD. But I mean, they take considerable risk there, like on growth companies, pre-IPO companies, or whatever. But there's a lot of risk in there. While with Bitcoin-backed lending, I mean, you have a collateral, highly liquid, tradable 24/7. All the loans are over-collateralized. They are not rehypothecated. It's really quite something. But I mean, on the positive side, especially speaking as a Bitcoiner now, I mean, I personally think the product that we are focusing right now on is has an end date. I mean, there is, especially now also in Switzerland, I mean, our leading rate, interest rate is 0% right now from our national bank. So the banks are looking into ways on how they can lend money. And we are working with banks, also with one that I hopefully can announce pretty soon, which will provide liquidity for Bitcoin-backed lending. And then we are talking about way lower rates. Like then we are talking about 3 to 3.5% on the Swiss franc. And that's going to happen. So it just takes time. It's unfortunately not as fast. And then, yeah, speaking as a Bitcoiner, I would love it to be faster and to be more efficient so that the whole economy can grow faster. I mean, there's a lot of value for a product like that.
Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. They make the Cold Card Q, my favorite hardware wallet, the most secure hardware wallet on the market. As you can see, it's got the BlackBerry form factor, full keyboard. It's got two secure enclaves. You create your private public keys offline. The device never has to go online, never does go online. So you keep your Bitcoin secure. If you have your Bitcoin on exchanges and you're looking to get it off, secure it in the best way possible. Pick up a Cold Card Q. Go to coinkite.com, find the Cold Card Q, use the code TFTC for 5% off. If you're a power user of Bitcoin, like I am, if you're running a business on a Bitcoin standard, if you're just a Bitcoiner who wants to secure your Bitcoin, get the most secure hardware wallet on the market, go get the Cold Card Q. It's a beautiful thing.
Sup, freaks? Guess what? We launched a browser extension. It's called Opportunity Cost, and it helps you see the true cost of everything in Bitcoin. Convert prices to Bitcoin as you browse the web. Opportunity Cost automatically displays fiat prices in Bitcoin or sats, helping you think in a Bitcoin standard. It works on Amazon, Zillow, X, your bank account, QuickBooks. You can convert everything to Bitcoin. It's really cool. It's also 100% open source, MIT license. We don't collect any data. All of the conversions happen in your browser on your local device. It's a great way to recalibrate your life and begin thinking in sats. Go check it out at opportunitycost.app. That's opportunitycost.app.
Yeah, and based off our last conversation from last month, you made me aware of something that I was completely unaware of, which was the relationship that Swiss regulators have with interest rates and how high they're willing to go.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite interesting at the moment, especially, I mean, when you look at it, right, the National Bank decreased the interest rates to 0%, as I mentioned. And so for banks now, they have an issue because their main business is how do you say that? It's like interest rate differences.
Yeah.
So they need to find ways to allocate the capital. And so that will have a very positive effect. But then I don't know if that's also what you were talking about. Our regulator gives or limits the banks on Bitcoin-backed lending and crypto lending, if you want to say so, with regards to that they still consider it as uncollateralized lending. And so that comes with very strict capital requirements. So that means that the bank, especially, let's say, younger banks with more like a crypto Bitcoin focus, they have a problem because their balance sheet is not as strong. And so because they would need to underlie all these loans with tier one capital. Tier one capital is essentially, in simpler terms, it's just equity capital. It's the most expensive capital for a bank. And so that means they are quite limited still. But it does, like the margins that they can generate right now, especially, are still attractive for that. So I think those are two important factors. We have the regulation, which will change, and then we have the interest rate pressure, which is already there. So you have banks that are looking into and say, okay, so we do have a couple of hundred millions that we can allocate to that, to Bitcoin-backed lending. And then we would need to find a solution that is outside of our balance sheet. And that's where we still come in. And then at one point, the regulation will also change. I'm 100% sure about that. And then it's basically the banking model, the traditional banks who provide capital for Bitcoin backlending, which is okay.
And isn't there an upper limit to the interest rate banks can charge as well?
It depends. So in Switzerland, it's like to private individuals, there are like consumer credit limits. That's at 9.9%. So they are not allowed to go higher. But for SMEs and companies, that limit is not in place.
Yeah. I'm just trying to get a well-rounded perspective on just the path to lowering the cost of capital for these Bitcoin-backed lending products. I think you said it perfectly, which is just the lack of liquidity that exists for these products specifically right now. That there's relatively little euros, francs, dollars competing for these loans. They're able to charge a higher rate. And bringing this back to the juxtaposition of Bitcoin collateralized lending versus the private debt markets that have exploded in recent years, they're taking what I would deem to be insane risk. When is that tipping point of banks and credit funds recognizing the relatively low risk provided by these collateralized Bitcoin products that floods the capital into the space?
I mean, there are multiple pieces of puzzle that fall into place, I would say, at the very moment. I mean, you see the Bitcoin treasury companies outperforming pretty much every other stock. And obviously, private debt funds are also looking at the stock markets. So and then they see, well, there is clearly value in that in that weird coin. so then they will realize, okay, so there is something that is way more transparent, that's the same price all over the world, and this is highly liquid. So that makes a lot of sense. And at the moment, and I would give it like 12 months, maybe max, they can still generate excessive returns, I would say, as compared to anything else that they would invest.
At $122,000 Bitcoin, the boom is still just beginning. Are you positioned for the decade-long rush? On July 22nd, Ter Demeester joins Unchained for a live session. The boom is just beginning. You'll get a full macro briefing and a brief intro to how to properly secure your Bitcoin for the long haul. Register now at unchained.com/TFTC. That's unchained.com/TFTC. Don't sit on this, freaks. Take advantage of this alpha.
How do you see the evolution of Bitcoin collateralized lending going? Because obviously, to date, it's been pretty vanilla. You put Bitcoin up in a wallet, typically over collateralized, LTVs around 50%, depending on the individual lender that you're interacting with, and you get cash back. But there's been the emergence of, as you mentioned, MicroStrategy like convertible bonds. There are different type of Bitcoin collateralized debt instrument to an extent. We've seen over here in the United States the emergence of companies like Battery Finance. They're doing dual collateralized sort of grade A credit in commercial real estate. Do you think Bitcoin, the meme of Bitcoin is super collateral, sort of getting injected into every nook and cranny of debt markets, has legs? This is something that I've been talking about on this show for probably the better part of a year and a half now. Is I think this is the cycle of Bitcoin as super collateral really shining and beginning to expand beyond the vanilla, put up Bitcoin as collateral, get dollars back, and get more, I don't want to say exotic, but get into more more complex structured credit products.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's clearly happening. And as usual, the US is probably about 2-3 years ahead of Europe. But I mean, that's basically the reason why we then said, okay, we start with just plain vanilla Bitcoin-backed lending, because it's the easiest to explain and how we believe we can crack the nut of getting fiat capital into the Bitcoin economy in the easiest way. But that's just the first step. I mean, then clearly, I mean, injecting it into real estate like Battery does is great. That has a lot of potential. We talked to a few real estate developers over here as well. And I mean, they are struggling with that as well. I mean, on mortgages, the rates that you pay for debt, etc., are phenomenal. But I mean, the bigger problem is for commercial real estate or bigger real estate projects when they have to calculate over the next 20, 30, 40 years. And then it's more on the CapEx side of things when suddenly all renovations cost 20, 30, 40% more because fiat just devalues all the time. And that's very hard to calculate in advance. So what they say is that, okay, so let's, from the amortization part, we put a bit in Bitcoin and we basically benefit from the acceleration of the price. And hence, we can make sure that our properties, they keep the value over time. And so that's also an easy to understand product. But then also, I would say, especially here in Switzerland, we have this, I don't know if it's a speciality, but it's quite interesting. So if you buy an apartment in a bigger building, then you own, it's called Stockwerk Eigentum. You basically own part of a floor, right? You own the apartment. But what you do is you pay in constantly every year, you pay in a so-called amortization fund. And what you can see there, which is also in the TradFi world, quite spectacular, I must say, it just lies around. It's just on an account. It doesn't work. And so suddenly you have, in the meanwhile, we have multiple hundred billions of dollars sitting in these funds because they do nothing. They don't work. And it's so easy to actually get them like to plan. For instance, I talked to a couple of friends of mine recently, and they bought a vacation home up in the mountains, and that is in one of these buildings. And then there were just about 250,000 Swiss francs lying around, and they already know that in 2030 there will be a bigger renovation project, and it will cost roughly at current prices about 400,000. Realistically, it will be 450 or something. And they just calculated as such that they just need to save until there. And so Bitcoin would be the ideal asset to save that part, that capital to actually get these renovations done. I fully agree with you. I mean, this is just one example that where Bitcoin will come into place and make sure that we can actually revolutionize the financial industry, the traditional financial industry.
Well, on that note, it's a perfect toss-up to what I wanted to talk about next is, I mean, you're partnered with Debify, Firefish, BitGo, all three of which, correct me if I'm wrong, do leverage some sort of multi-sig escrow for the Bitcoin when it's used as collateral. And so I think that's been a big topic of discussion here in the United States is the centralization of custodian risk with a lot of the ETFs flooding their Bitcoin to Coinbase. And I've long been an advocate of if the banking system and traditional finance is going to step into Bitcoin in earnest, that we really need to take a step back and think about the optimal sort of custody and how to custody the collateral when it's being used in the system. And I think multi-institution, multi-sig makes the most sense to me because you really create an incentive structure that really disincentivizes against rehypothecation and concentrated third-party risk.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I started with Berglinde and basically had the ideologue Bitcoin image in mind and thought, okay, so it's going to be multi-sig above all. And this is where we focus on, and we still do. I think it is a good way, but it also comes with limitations. And so, and now looking at the exact processes of all the platform, I mean, it is sometimes it's hard to argue why a regulated custodian isn't safer, so to say, because then you have, I mean, when you look at processes of regulated banks, we have two in Switzerland who are fully focused on Bitcoin or unfortunately crypto as a whole. And I mean, when you look at their risk policies, at their risk processes, then sometimes it's hard to argue why this should be less secure than the multi-sig setups of of some startups, so to say. And so there is still a way to go, I would say. And I also think the right way to tackle it is multi-institution, but professional institutions, not some random one single or one key holder or so somewhere. But yes, I mean, this is also going to be built up, I would say. And I don't know how it is in the US. I mean, you clearly have a few players who are already working on that. I think in Europe, this is something that we have to tackle over the next 2 years or so.
Yeah, I think the dream scenario here in the United States is Fidelity, who's been in Bitcoin for over a decade now at this point in a century-old institution here in the United States, really stepping out on the ledge. And I think an entity like Fidelity needs to be the one to push multi-institution, multi-sig to get that seal of approval from not only regulators, but traditional financial players who really respect the prestige and the century-long track record of Fidelity. I think somebody like them stepping out and saying, all right, we're going to be a key agent in a quorum of a multi-institution, multi-sig would be a massive step forward.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I mean, something like that would really change the way people look at custody, also on the institutional level. Because, I mean, so far when we talk to more institutional type of clients, I mean, either corporations who are looking for a loan, then the multi-sig setup doesn't work. It's always a regulated custodian. And if a player like Fidelity, or I mean the equivalent in Europe, it doesn't really matter, could come up with something, I mean, even better would be some sort of like a global consortium of multiple institutions. That would be great. Because then we can really scale it to the institutional level as well.
Yeah. So shifting gears towards Europe specific perspective on Bitcoin. I mean, you've mentioned it a couple of times. Seems like European regulators are 2 to 3 years behind what's happening here in the United States. Obviously, you have the MiCA regulations that have gone live this year in Europe, and there are many people that are worried about the state of the broader Eurozone economy. What are your thoughts about Europe as it pertains to Bitcoin regulation, and can the success of Bitcoin be a catalyst to force more free market operations within Europe?
Yeah, I mean, Europe as a whole is a difficult topic at the moment, I would say, not only financial regulation-wise, but also general macroeconomic-wise. It's quite challenging. I mean, the European Union is, their primary strength is regulation, which is a bad thing in the first place. I mean, luckily, I'm based in Switzerland, so we are not in the European Union, and it's also one of the main reasons why we are doing much better than every country surrounding us. So this is also my personal primary motive these days. Like I just try to do everything I can to so that we are not getting too close to this regulatory monster that surrounds us. Right now it is, I mean, but also in Switzerland, I mean, you've seen an interesting development. We pushed forward quite good in 2017, 2018, under a different financial minister, but then kind of slept in, so to say, and then a lot of countries bypassed us, and hopefully we can change that again. I mean, now our regulator is a bit scared given the downfall of Credit Suisse 2 years ago, so they really try to avoid any risk. But this will hopefully change. I mean, we're pushing on all fronts that they are a bit less risk averse, especially on the Bitcoin scene. And there's clearly a lot of interest right now from the industry, so I'm positive that we can change at least the Swiss regulator. regulator's perspective over the next few months. On Europe as a whole, I mean, it's really difficult for me to understand how these processes work. I mean, it's heavily centralized. Europe gets more and more centralized, and the problems that they are dealing with these days are much broader than just financial problems, right? It's especially energy is a big issue in Europe. I mean, the whole industry, or Germany, one of the powerhouses of Europe in the past is just strangled by insane energy prices and ludicrous policies around that. So I mean, this is, in my opinion, probably even more important than the regulation around Bitcoin for them. And I really hope they can change the direction there. Other than that, I mean, can Bitcoin be a catalyst for sovereignty? For sure. Will it be a catalyst for growing economy? I hope so. But I mean, you cannot get like institutions or corporations, if they are not allowed to do that, you won't get them to do that, right? It's different on the individual level, but for corporates, it's tricky. So far, unfortunately, it still looks like in Europe the pain is not big enough, so that. that the politicians really change. So we will see. I hope, but I'm quite skeptical on the European Union and the way they handle pretty much everything.
Well, it's like, what is going to be the catalyst? Do you imagine it like Bitcoin has another very successful cycle throughout the rest of this year, potentially into next year, and you see a lot of the activity happening here in the United States, Southeast Asia, other parts of the world where people are really embracing it and leveraging the sort of monetization and adoption of Bitcoin to their benefit, and sort of people sitting in corporations in Europe looking out at the world, basically embracing this technology and succeeding massively because of that, and pushing back against the regulator saying, look what's happening around us, we're completely missing out on this. Is that what it's going to take? Or...
Yeah, is most there, probably. But usually, yeah. I mean, usually it has to start with quite a bit policy change, and then the politicians will force the regulator to act. And I mean, there we can see some effects. So one example is in Norway, they started with an insane wealth tax, just another socialist experiment that failed massively. So they installed this wealth tax, and as a result, a lot of the Norwegian billionaires, they moved to Switzerland, which is great for us when it's terrible for the country. And also, obviously, the net result is that they lost tax revenues, and at the significant scale. And you see that in many different places now as well. And in Germany, they also try to increase taxes again or increase debt, which will cause inflation, which they already saw. I mean, the euro had so heavy inflation over the last few years already. So, and I think there needs to be, like, people start to realize that more and more. They realize, hey, we're being cheated on here. So that doesn't work. Like, suddenly we have 10% and higher inflation, and things are not getting any better, while our country has record tax revenues, but the infrastructure is bad. So a lot of these things come together, and then they see in parallel Bitcoin appreciates a lot, and then you see the Arab countries and a lot of Asian countries, and the US especially under the new administration really pushes forward on the Bitcoin side. And clearly they see these successful examples, and I think this will help. And then hopefully that's going to be the catalyst. In the end, I personally believe it's always going to be price action in one way or the other, right? It's just...
Getting to a spicier conversation. So do you think discussions about whether or not the European Union, the economic agreement between some European states, is a failure after 30 years? And
I think the European Union is a massive failure. It's on pretty much all fronts. I mean, It's a centralizing experiment, and it just doesn't work. It consolidates power on unelected bureaucrats, which is pretty much the worst thing you can do. Nevertheless, they still tried. So, and it clearly doesn't work. Clearly, I mean, all the countries are struggling economically. It doesn't like the. All the policies around immigration don't work. They do not collaborate properly. So yeah, I think it's a matter of time. Either, and that's going to be the big discussion or the big surprise, unfortunately, it's either going to be that they will clearly push for like a United States of Europe, which could be an outcome. Because there, especially in the southern part of Europe, there are still a lot of countries who are somewhat benefiting from it, at least on the outside. They don't really, but they feel like they benefit from it. Or the European Union will fall apart. It's either or in the next 3 years, 3 to 5 years, I would say. Because
yeah, it's crazy. I'm having flashbacks to reading Boomerang by Michael Lewis, where he sort of describes that dynamic between Northern Europe and Southern Europe, where Greece and Italy essentially being completely subsidized by the German economy in the early 2010s.
Yeah, but yeah, absolutely. And but now you can see it in a different way almost. I mean, Italy now, okay, it's not perfect, but it's one of the more stable countries. And also economically, they're not doing that bad. I mean, now suddenly, and that's always what happens in these centralized structures. It's like there is an orientation downwards. So Germany will go lower instead of everybody else goes up. That's just how it is. That's why socialism never works, right? And it's just because of the distance from the government structure to the actual people is too big. It doesn't make any sense, and there's a lot of corruption in this whole process. And yeah, so yeah. We will see. But it's going to be interesting. But I mean, people realize it more and more, and you see it in elections all over the place. There's still some forces trying to push against it, but I don't think it will be successful.
Yeah, the information, I say this a lot in the context of how politics here in the United States, particularly in DC at the federal government level, is completely disconnected. And it's basically what you describe from an information system perspective. They're so far away from the raw input data, it's like impossible for them to make rational decisions on behalf of people thousands of miles away.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They don't feel it. And it's not, it's always, sometimes when I talk about these topics, it's like you start claiming like, yet though they cannot do it, but it's human. It's human nature. I mean, this is just how it is. If it's not your money, then you spend it differently. If you don't feel the consequences of your actions, then you act differently. That's how it is. That's natural. That's, by the way, one of the key advantages of our political system in Switzerland, or how I look at it, at least. Yeah. Because we have this direct democracy, and it's very fragmented. Just very small country, but fragmented in 26 cantons, and everybody has a vote and can vote against pretty much every decision anybody takes. So that's
they compete. Correct me if I'm wrong. They compete on sort of tax preference too, right? Trying to
tax preferences, education. I mean, the overall system is quite similar to the U.S. system. It's a republic in the end. But we changed our constitution in 1848 based on the American Constitution. One thing that we added is that it's not like our constitution is not like such a sacred document. It's quite dynamic, actually. So everybody can pretty much change it. So you just need compared to our size, obviously, that's like when you need 100,000 signatures and then it comes to a public vote. So we can have referendums against pretty much every decision any politician takes. And that's on the federal level, on the cantonal, which is your state level, and on the municipality level as well. And so that's why we have like 300 referendums every year, but it keeps politicians in check. And also, given the tax competition that we have, you can see the impact much faster, much closer.
And if you had a magic wand to fix the European Union problems, I know you're separated in Switzerland, but what would you do? What is the optimal path to untangling the sort of centralized control that the European Union has over member states?
Break it down to a free trade agreement and then split it apart. Like just say, okay, so there's going to be free trade, so economical freedom, so to say, which is good. I mean, people trade, that's good, and that helps. But then pretty much get rid of the European Union and build a Europe of 1,000 Liechtensteins or 1,000 Switzerlands, or just go back to country level.
Yeah,
and compete. I mean, that's the thing, right? That's like it's this weird image that some politicians have, is that it's better when you centralize and everything bigger is better. That's not true. It's just way better if we build on a smaller scale and we compete against each other. We compete with ideas, with structures, with governance, and that really helps. And I mean, you can see it. It's just, for me, then that's also sometimes quite frustrating. I mean, our relationship to the European Union comes back every 5 years, pretty much, and some sort of an election. And we will have a very important election soon, which basically, because some people want to be much closer to the European Union and basically automatically take over regulation from Europe just to get access to the European market, which we already have, by the way, but apparently that should be easier. And now a lot of people are fighting against it. And to me, this is just, I can't get my head around how people can just look at the simple facts. Like, on every economical KPI, we're doing better than the European Union. And you can clearly see it. I mean, 20 years ago, the European Union had the same GDP per capita as the US. Now the US is, what, 40% higher or something. And so on every KPI, it failed. Nevertheless, there are still people who think it's a good idea to go for it.
Yeah. It's mind-boggling to me watching from afar, particularly the energy, like how Germany completely just shot itself in the foot over the last 20 years with this energy policy. And
that's unbelievable. It's really unbelievable. And I mean, it's now they're being deindustrialized in real time. And they had a super strong economy, right? Super strong industry. And now all the companies are struggling, and obviously that trickles down. If Volkswagen struggles, then thousands of smaller companies struggle as well. It's just the primary reason is energy prices. And there seemed to be some sort of a reluctance on the political elite, so to say, to change their mind, because it was clearly a mistake. It was such a big mistake. I mean, you can now, I mean, they got rid of their nuclear reactors, right? Or they stopped it because of Fukushima in Japan. And now even Japan started building new nuclear reactors again, and Germany doesn't. But it's a nightmare.
No, you had the instance in, I forget if it was 2022 or 2023, when after they decommissioned a couple of their nuclear power plants, they were forced to ship coal up the Rhine, and then the Rhine ran dry, and they couldn't get the coal to the power facilities, so they had like power outages. And
no, it's really the stupidity of it all is mind-boggling.
Yeah. I mean, with that, I think transitioning this back to Bitcoin, I think you gave a keynote presentation in Prague last month. It was titled "Bitcoin, a Political Force Reshaping Global Governance." And I am a strong believer that Bitcoin can be a vehicle, a mechanism, a rallying cry, that people rally around and basically leverage to effectuate the political change they want to see in the world. And so I think you believe this too, based off of your keynote. And I think just diving into some of the topics you covered there would be great.
Yeah, definitely. I see it in it's multi-dimensional. I mean, the first part is clearly the buying power and the monetary things. Obviously, that will have effect on politics in one way or the other. Pretty soon, you saw it already in the U.S. Clearly, the last election was also influenced by probably pretty strong donations coming from people who made good money with Bitcoin, I would say, and clearly that has some sort of an impact, probably. But then it goes much further, right? I mean, this is where I hope that we, with education, we can also do our part. I mean, the effects on weak currencies are just so bad, and everybody in Bitcoin knows it. A lot of the people are not in Bitcoin, unfortunately, so they don't know it. And I hope, and that was also part of my keynote, Switzerland was the last country who got rid of the gold standard. It was only by the end of the 90s, so it was relatively recently. And for some weird reason, I mean, it's not the gold standard fixed in a way that every Swiss franc was backed by gold. That wasn't the case, but the national bank was required to have a certain percentage in gold when they printed money. So, and that hindered them as well. It was also diluted over 70 years, but not as bad. And so that was the primary reason why the Swiss franc remains so strong. And for some reason, people or international investors still believe that, because every time when the dollar drops, the Swiss franc goes up. And I really hope that, given everything we see and given the success of Bitcoin, we can educate the people as well that sound money makes a lot of sense for society. And that people see that there is a reason why we have, in Switzerland, we have a much more dynamic industry as compared to every other country surrounding us. And that's the primary reason was that these companies, they had to remain dynamic, innovative, lean. They had to push things forward, while in the country surrounding us, they had access to very cheap capital and they got lazy, and therefore things didn't work. And that's just one effect of weak currency. So I hope that with the success of Bitcoin, we can educate society as a whole more about like the hard money in general. But then that's also what I realized. It's that because about 5 years ago, I wrote a blog about what Bitcoin and Switzerland has in common. And it's essentially what I just tried to explain before. Switzerland is very, very decentralized. It's the people are on top and politicians are servants to the people. And that works like that there's nobody who can decide about pretty much anything. It's always the people who decide in one way or the other. And that's quite comparable to the Bitcoin system. That's basically the nodes. Well, nodes are the masters, right? So obviously we have the miners are very important, but in the end, they're servants. And also there's not some superpower who can just decide and change monetary policy, which is great. So there are a lot of common factors. And I also believe that's the reason, because we have direct democracy here. So we can vote. Every single individual has a vote about pretty much everything. And that helps. It pushes, like, it makes us slow, but it makes us very stable. And that rings a bell when you look at how Bitcoin works. So slower is better than faster. Politicians with less power is better than more power. And sometimes doing less is more. And that's also how I look at it from in the Bitcoin world. Yeah.
Yeah. And something I don't think is talked about enough, like honing in on Switzerland too. I'm sure you see me typing back here. I was just doing some quick research in ChatGPT. But the Swiss National Bank has a considerable position in MicroStrategy, which is a signal to me that they sort of know what they're doing to a certain extent, that they're trying to get proxy exposure to this rapidly appreciating asset.
Yeah, this is an interesting debate. I mean, we have two or three people who go to the General Assembly of the National Bank every year and then basically have a short speech, and they calculate how much money the Swiss National Bank lost because they didn't invest in Bitcoin since a while. And it's constantly the same thing. And then I think their claim was a couple of years ago was that instead of buying all these worthless government bonds from countries surrounding us, you should buy like 5% in Bitcoin. And then they go back every year and calculate and explain to them how much money they lost so far. So there is a bit of pressure around that they should focus on it more. So far, the National Bank always said, well, they feel like it's not big enough yet, but they are monitoring it. When it comes to MicroStrategy, I mean, this is also an interesting debate, because I also thought so in the beginning. And then I saw an interesting presentation by one of the, I think it was even the president of the National Bank. And they said, well, just in general, they just need to push down the Swiss franc. Otherwise, it appreciates too much against all other fiat currencies. And therefore, they print Swiss franc and then they buy all sorts of assets in different other currencies. And so, speaking about MicroStrategy, they say they basically just buy whatever USD denominated asset they can get their hands on. And it's less about the actual asset, it's just that they want USD exposure. So I was quite happy when I saw that the first time, and then I was a bit like, meh, okay. That's not as exciting as I thought it is.
I thought the Swiss National Bank was speculative attacking itself.
Probably. There are two points to that, right? It's like the balance sheet of the Swiss National Bank is massive. They printed a lot of Swiss francs recently over the last 5 years as well. The good thing about Switzerland is it doesn't finance the state. It just suddenly became basically a massive hedge fund. And it's then almost some sort of a sovereign wealth fund just sitting with the National Bank. So the money doesn't trickle down in the economy and dilutes everything and creates all sorts of wrong incentives. But it's generally wrong that that the National Bank has a big balance sheet in the first place. So.
Yeah, that'll be. I've had discussions about this with a couple of friends in the past. The fact that they own MicroStrategy, and based off of our discussion over the last hour, like there's a lot of talk here in the United States of putting Bitcoin in the Treasury. You know, I think we're pretty, at least this administration is ardent about. We don't want it to sit at the Fed. We'd rather it sit at the Treasury, but. If you think about sort of this idea of free banking and a lot of the ideas in the Bitcoin standard, particularly towards the end, where SAFE's like Bitcoin's greatest success would be forcing central banks to have sort of better monetary policy or stricter monetary policy to remove the opportunity cost and the misallocation of capital. And I don't know the answer to this, but I go back and forth like, is it worthwhile, or should we be pushing, it's probably the better framing, central banks to hold Bitcoin as an asset on their balance sheet? And if so, who's going to move first? And based off of this conversation, I think Switzerland has proven to be sort of forward thinking when it comes to Bitcoin, even though it's had some lulls since 2017. But could you see the Swiss National Bank if this... contingency of Bitcoiners going year in and year out and highlighting the losses for not allocating Bitcoin, actually making the decision to get some Bitcoin?
Yeah, I could see. I hope so, to be honest. I mean, this is another interesting topic because there's currently an initiative ongoing on people who want to force the National Bank to put Bitcoin on the balance sheet. Now, they have another year to collect these 100,000 signatures, and then it's going to be a vote in 3 to 4 years from now. So it's a longer project. And especially within the local Bitcoin community, that is heavily debated. Because there are a lot of people who say, well, people cannot be or Bitcoin cannot be enforced on anyone or any institution, and they don't want the National Bank to hold Bitcoin. I see a lot, I see that argument. In my opinion, in the end, it's also a bit of geopolitical competition, right? So do I generally want to see the National banks to own Bitcoin? I think there's no way around it. So at one point this will happen. And then I would much rather see us gaining that buying power, that economical power over the next few years, other than any other country in general. Or obviously there are more friendly countries than others, but I think there's no way around it. So I do think over the next, give it 4 years, there's a good chance that that at least a small portion will be allocated in Bitcoin.
Do you think we're reaching a critical tipping point in terms of adoption, an event horizon, if you will, about Bitcoin?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, now you can clearly see it with all these treasury companies coming out of the woods. I mean, obviously, that's kind of the adoption curve comes from cypherpunks, software developers, and then individuals in general, and then it goes up the curve, and then it goes to more to companies, to institutions, and then at one point it will be countries. And right now we can clearly see the critical point on in the private markets or with companies. I mean, there are so many companies now putting Bitcoin on their own treasury. There are now a lot of strategies to accumulate as many Bitcoin as somewhat possible, and clearly that's a path towards more countries. And let's see who's first from the actual, like, let's say G20 or something countries. But yeah, definitely, I would bet a lot of money that that's going to happen over the next 2 years, and let's see.
It's a brave new world. Nice. And I appreciate you taking some time. Hopefully this is the first of many conversations, because I think your perspective is incredibly valuable from Switzerland. As you can tell in the background, my father-in-law has decided to start mowing the lawn. So we may...
wow, that's important as well.
We may have to wrap up here, but where can anybody who's interested about what you're doing at Berglinda contact you and helping your efforts to get better Bitcoin collateralized products to market?
Yeah, you find me on X and on Noster. Always open for interesting conversations. Always, you also find my email address online. So feel free to reach out and let's discuss on what we can build together for the Bitcoin economy. Very much looking forward to it.
All right, we'll link to all that in the show notes. Phil, sorry for the noise here at the end, but... Oh. We'll do this another time. Peace and love, freaks.
Great. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Freaks, thank you for listening to the show. I hope you liked it. If you did like it, please make sure you subscribe, rate, review the show. It helps us out a lot. And also, if you like these conversations, I've come to realize that many people listen to the podcast. They don't know we have another sort of layer of this media company. We have the newsletter, the Bitcoin Brief. Go to tftc.io. Make sure you subscribe there. A lot of the topics that are discussed on this podcast, I write about 5 days a week in the newsletter. We also have the TFTC Elite tier. If you sign up for that, become a member. We have a private Discord server for the elite freaks out there, where we're dropping ad-free versions of this show and having discussions about everything we talk about a day early. Logan wanted me to make sure, if you want to get the show a day early, become a TFTC Elite member, you will get that. We have our Discord server. Right now it's conversation between myself
and TFTC elite tier members, but we're going to expand that. We'll probably do closed Q&As with people in the industry. I may be doing Macro Mondays. So join us. Go to tftc.io. Subscribe. Find the button in the top right corner of the website. Become a TFTC elite member. Thank you for joining us. Okay.